From economics to the woke agenda, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, we had the big White House Correspondents' Dinner here in Washington, D.C. this past weekend. And by the way, this used to be my specialty, was covering the White House and the Congressional Correspondents' Dinner. There were annual events in Washington, D.C. back 30 years ago. Exactly, 32 years ago is when I started that kind of coverage. I did this for Rush Limbaugh, the television show. This is where all of official Washington, cabinet, bureaucrats, presidents, vice presidents, senators, congressmen, corporate, lobbyists, the media. Oh, the media is legion at these events. And I used to plant myself for Rush Limbaugh, the television show, by the bathrooms. Because as the evening wore on, usually they'd have the regular media would have been covering people as they came in, got some inane comments, a couple quips. I was there to have some fun and do the entertainment and delve a little deeper sometimes into politics. So I was able to get all kinds of fun video clips. And Rush Limbaugh, to the day he died, would still talk about some of the interviews I got with drunk senators, congressmen. One of them was a U.S. senator from Pennsylvania. Here's Wofford, who looked inebriated. Another was Clinton Press Secretary Mike Curry. I would hang out until late in the evening and get people coming and going in the bathroom. Not in the bathroom, but outside the lobby. I knew where to stake it out, where the security was. Had a lot of fun covering those events. And they've turned, you know, this would have been the early Clinton years. And these events have just turned so... yeah, stayed, if you will. The jokes are safe, except for a few years. I think Michelle Wolf would be an exception. And this year we had Colin Jost of the, I believe he's the Comedy Channel or whatever he is. He was the resident comedian, the comedian Colin Jost, and he still, you know, treated Biden with kid gloves before going off into all the boring stuff. But he did have one good joke, a couple good jokes about Joe Biden. But anyway, here's a little sample of Colin Jost at the White House Correspondents' Dinner here in Washington, D.C. This is the comedian trying his best. And then we're going to have a little flashback after this. Roll clip one.
It's also wonderful to be back in Washington. I love being in Washington. The last time I was in D.C., I left my cocaine at the White House. Luckily, the president was able to put it to good use for his State of the Union. I'm kidding, of course. The president doesn't call it cocaine. He calls it high-speed rail.
I got to give him credit for that. That was a pretty good joke. And I believe that, you know, that was probably the, you know, maybe one or two, but very light kid glove treatment. But that one really rang home because, you know, he doesn't have any personality when he does it. But Joe Biden can still read a teleprompter, and although sometimes way too literally, where he'll say pause and you know, applause, cheers, parentheses. I mean, he'll do all kinds of silly stuff reading it literally. But of course, that's referring to a lot of the Washington rumors that Joe Biden was juiced for the State of the Union just to have the energy level. But he was still just an angry, shouting man. I mean, it's just it's creepy to watch. It's not like, oh, he's cognitively there. It's like, no, he's shouting and has energy at that moment. We're going to take you back 10 years now. This is a full 10 years ago. This is the 2014 White House Correspondents' Decade Dinner. Joe Biden's cognitive decline was even made jokes back then in 2014. So let's roll clip two. This is, by the way, this is Joel McHale, actor, comedian, who was the comedian in the keynote for the 2014. But listen to this joke at Joe Biden's expense, then Vice President Joe Biden under Obama, barely 70 years old back here. Roll clip two.
The vice president isn't here tonight, not for security reasons. He just thought this event was being held at the Dulles Airport Applebee's. Yes, right now, Joe is elbow deep in jalapeno poppers and talking to a construction cone he thinks is John Boehner. Also true. It's crazy to think that Joe Biden is only one heartbeat away from no one taking him seriously as president. Sorry for that one.
And did you notice then President Obama laughing knowingly? This was the consensus. These are the people that cover, this is the White House press corps, who cover then Vice President Joe Biden every day. A lot of them had covered Joe Biden on Capitol Hill for 30, 40 years. He was elected like 1972. Maybe it was 73, 74. They all knew this about him, even at his best, meaning it not age-related cognitive decline. The man was a dim bulb. And of course, they're having it at his expense. That's just a reminder, 10 years ago, those were the jokes on Joe Biden. All right. As we know, last week was all about climate emergency. I'm going to have a story at the top of the next hour about the Washington Post editorial board declaring, and I'm not making this up, I'll give you details in the next hour, humans might need to re-engineer the climate, unquote. Yes, this isn't some obscure op-ed or the drudge up. This is the Washington Post editorial board, full pay, full salary, from none other than billionaire Jeff Bezos. So we'll get into that. But along those same lines, we were talking about the climate emergency last week and how Joe Biden would have, according to NBC News, COVID-like powers, 9/11-like emergency powers. And one of the things that they've set up here is unless we are willing to live on a wartime footing of rationing voluntarily, unless we're willing to go along with their edicts without too much protest and their mandates, we are going to have to do radical, risky, experimental things on the atmosphere to stop global warming. It's that bad. So this is what the flip side, and that's what I think a lot of this climate, the geoengineering of the climate is, but we'll get to that in the next hour. Well, clip three is Steve Forbes, the founder of Forbes magazine, discussing how invoking a climate emergency would wreck the economy and even increase energy prices even more. This is clip three, Steve Forbes laying out the impact of Joe Biden becoming a climate dictator in America.
Joining us now, Forbes Media Chair and Editor-in-Chief Steve Forbes. Steve, it's good to see you.
Good to be with you.
What do you make of this breaking news coming in from Bloomberg News? President Biden is considering declaring a climate change emergency, a national emergency, to get out the youth vote for the election. How are we going to have to pay for this?
What you do is you're going to pay for it with even a more troubled economy. That would give them the power to stop drilling offshore, stop export of crude. And they think that'll help lower gasoline prices here, delay pipelines and the like, just throttle the whole fossil fuel industry even more than they're doing. What that only does is wreck the economy, means higher energy prices. Just look at Europe. Germany has 2 to 3 times the electricity cost of the U.S. because of the kind of stuff the Biden administration is doing now. They've learned a hard lesson. This administration's throwing it all away, all sensible policies away, as a cheap way, cowardly way to try to win this election. I think young people most will see through it. A lot of verbiage that's going to end up doing them harm as well.
And I think he's dead on accurate. That's Steve Forbes on Fox News laying out what a Joe Biden climate emergency would do to our economy. That's just the economic impacts. And that's not even the worst by far. It's the idea of further energy restrictions, collapsing agriculture and meat eating, and affecting your freedom of movement without a single vote of democracy. And that's where you get into the great reset style of what Joe Biden is doing. And by the way, just to give you a little update, CNN headline, blah, 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 blah. Ford just reported a massive loss on every electric vehicle it sold. This is CNN just a couple days ago. This is April 25th, 2024. And here it is. Ford's losses soared in the first 3 months of 2024 to $1.3 billion in losses, or $132,000 for each of the 10,000 EV vehicles it's 10,000 vehicles it sold. This is all due to the EV mandate. Despite the EV losses, Ford said in a call it is making changes and that the company's planned next generation EVs will allow it to be profitable. So what I'm hearing is, yeah, things look like shit right now, but prosperity's just around the corner with new EVs. We are doubling down on failure. The Ford Pro, which primarily sells traditional internal combustion engine, was the primary profit driver for Ford. How about that? Good old gas-powered, petrol-powered cars were the only primary profit driver at Ford Motor Company. But hey, those EVs, they're going to rake in money. You know how we know that? You know how Ford knows the EVs? They have some economic model projections into the future, which say all is well in the world of EVs. The primary profit driver for it, $3 billion and more than double what it made a year ago. So they were just booming, the gas-powered cars. The number of vehicles sold by the gas-powered division was up 21%. In other words, gas-powered cars aren't fading away. They are going up, 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 and away! On Tuesday, Tesla, the world's largest EV maker, not for long when China catches up, reported that its adjusted earnings plunged 48% in the first quarter as revenue fell 9% after it reported first, this is important, Elon Musk Tesla reported the first year-over-year drop in sales since the pandemic. Now, and I believe it's only the first time in history, non-pandemic, non-virus scare related. I'm not going to call it a pandemic. So this is important because I've said on this show many times, Elon Musk is toast as top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 wealthiest man in the world. He's going to drop probably out of the top 10. I don't know enough about the nuances of those lists once you get past the top 10, but he's out. He has angered, pissed off the ruling class, governing elite on a whole host of narratives, climate, COVID lockdowns, free speech, and that's probably those three alone. That's it. It's going to affect his government contracts with Neuralink, his brain, his any other contractors who's now toxic to deal with. It's going to affect EV work because that relied on the climate scare, which he dutifully pushed until about 3-4 years ago. And it's going to rely on the fact that all these progressives and liberals out there who used to love the Teslas are like, I'm not supporting that guy. He's a Nazi. He's a this, he's a that. He's a right-wing extremist. He's a Trumper, whatever they're calling him now. Sales are going to continue to plunge on that. And it's also the fact that we have given the massive subsidies, the massive mandates. I think we're hitting EV saturation. But hey, let me just read you one again. The Ford CEO, Jim Farley, said in a call with investors, the company is making changes in its EV business and that the company's planned next generation of EVs will allow it to be profitable on that business in the near future. Don't worry. Everything sucks now, has sucked in the past. EVs are a complete drain. They're an absolute disaster. We were afraid to go after the people who regulate us. You heard the lady Diana Fergott-Roth last week on the show here on Unleashed said that one of the reasons the auto industry just caved to all these demands and mandates for EVs is these were the regulators coming to them and saying, with a gun to their head, saying, hey, here's what you need to do. And they said, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. No pushback at all. And now they're telling investors, hey, don't worry. Everything sucks now. It's an absolute financial disaster. But I'm going to read you the line again. The company is making changes in the EV business and our planned next generation will be profitable. Ding. I wish I had like a gold tooth or something, or something to sparkle in my mouth. Yeah. Our economic projections show everything's going to be great with EVs. Just like a government projection that's doing so well. Holy, I cannot believe all this. Well, there's one other story related to this, and this is the most frightening of all. Cheap Chinese EVs pose a threat to America's auto industry. A China-made electric vehicle is coming to America this summer. And President Biden's fixation is resulting in EV fixation is resulting in Chinese-made electric vehicles coming to the U.S. this summer, $8,000 cheaper than any competitor. So that's going to be really hard to deal with. And that's the lowest model Tesla. It's $8,000 cheaper. The vehicle's called the Volvo EX30 and will avoid tariffs because Volvo has a plant in the United States. A lot of these things, by the way, are scams. Like, oh, these are U.S. made. Yeah, they make everything everywhere else, ship them to the U.S., and then the final, you know, in a lot significantly constructed form. And then the U.S. plant will do some final touches or final assembly, and then they say they're U.S. made, so we qualify. Give us more tax money. So it also may end up with U.S. taxpayers just funding Chinese-made cars. Volvo was purchased by China's Geely years ago. So Volvo is a Chinese company now. And the companies are sharing common platforms and configurations among vehicles. Domestic manufacturers see it as a harbinger of massive Chinese exports of vehicles to the U.S. using loopholes in the trade agreement to skirt the intent of the U.S. laws. Of course. Oh my gosh, we were assured by everyone, Republican and Democrat, all these free trade laws, they're going to work. This is going to be great. Yeah, it's working out great. But hey, the models show economic projections are going to be awesome. Okay. Next story. This is a Fox News guest. This is awesome. This is a former CA operations officer warning about how electric vehicles pose environmental problems and national security issues, as well as compromise the safety of drivers. Clip four.
You guys have probably all heard
about electric vehicles. They're often told or sold to us as green. But is that true? And the answer is no, they're not as green or clean as we are often told. So if we can imagine and try to understand that, imagine that you walk into a dealership and you are looking at an EV. What you see in front of you is not a green or a clean machine. It's actually very, very dirty. We can start with the batteries. Those are thousands of pounds of minerals from all around the world that first have to be extracted. Well, we know that the cobalt mostly comes from the Congo. They've got about 70% of the world's overall supply. Of that 70%, about a third of it comes from artisanal miners. Those are mostly kids. So that is a horrific thing, imagining there are these child miners pulling this stuff out of the ground to make our green cars go. But that is true. We also know that we've got a lot of lithium and we've also got a lot of nickel. So the lithium, most of that actually comes from Australia, but we also know that a whole bunch of it comes from the Atacama Desert, which is called the Lithium Triangle in South America. Very, very problematic there because it's extraordinarily dry, but the lithium extraction down there requires a ton of water. So now we are removing the one critical resource by a lot of those indigenous folks down there so we can have our green and clean car. Then we've got nickel. So we've got a lot of nickel coming from some from Canada, but a lot of it from Indonesia. And they use an extraction method using sulfuric acid, which creates a ton of problems in terms of the settling ponds afterwards after they extract the nickel. And that creates a major economic or ecological disaster for the folks in that country. And it has. Again, we've got all kinds of problems just extracting this stuff out of the ground, from child labor to environmental damage. But then we got to refine it. So that gets then sent to China, where about 80% of all this stuff is actually refined. In some of those places, it is being refined by power that is coal power. So we know that we're not really green or clean there either. Some of it is occurring in the Xinjiang area where they use concentration camp labor. So we've got yet another dirty element to this car as we're sitting in a dealership. A lot of folks don't know they're looking at a horrifically dirty vehicle. At the end of the day, EVs are not just about the environment. It's about national security.
And that was Brian Dean Wright, former CIA operations officer and host of the podcast, The Wright Report. He was on Fox News explaining that. Spot on everything he said. You're not allowed to question narratives anymore, which brings us to our final clip. Tucker Carlson defending the idea that we need to challenge and question everything in today's society. Clip five, good old Tucker Carlson explaining why free speech is probably the most important hallmark of a free society.
I find it fascinating that many conservatives are now lambasting Tucker Carlson for asking certain hard questions about narratives we've been fed by the government. Do I agree with Tucker on all of his views? Of course not. I don't agree with anybody on 100% of their views. That would be a weird thing to do. But I also think it's a weird thing to do to lambast somebody for questioning certain narratives when, in fact, that's what it means to be a skeptical citizen of a truly democratic nation. I'll tell you where it comes from, though. I'm not just going to tar somebody on their side. Let's get to the heart of what's going on there. I think we as conservatives have appropriately been fed up by the self-loathing left that has repeatedly, for 160 years, and for the last 6 years incessantly, questioned the founding of our country, obsessing over systemic racism and white rage and the original sin of slavery at our founding. And at a certain point, all of us, most conservatives I know, myself included, Tucker included, others, are saying enough with it already. Let's move forward as one country because we've beaten that dead horse to death. There's nothing more to say. Now, back in 1960, when you didn't have necessarily equal rights enjoyed across this country, that was still a relevant conversation to have, to say, well, slavery existed all the way through the Civil War. The Reconstruction era didn't quite put an end to those inequities. How are we going to deal with it in the Civil Rights Revolution? That was a reasonable discussion to have. But now we're 60 plus years after that, and at a certain point, it's time to move on. And if you're consistently still obsessing over narratives dating back over 250 years, then yes, that means you probably do in some measure hate this country. Fine. But that's different from saying that there are certain areas where we deserve to question our own history that haven't been questioned. And I think that that's the difference we need to draw. The distinction we need to draw is one thing to beat a dead horse and hate ourselves for the sake of hating ourselves. That's what the modern left does. But that's not what Tucker's doing. To the contrary, he's turning over rocks that haven't really been turned over, rolling over logs that deserve to be rolled over and seeing what crawls out. Sometimes maybe there's nothing there. Is he going to have a 100% hit rate? Of course not. But I don't think it's the right thing to do, especially as conservatives who are supposed to be skeptical of the government, to criticize somebody for asking questions, and not just in a armchair way, but in a rigorous way, asking the kinds of questions that at least the American people deserve to have answers to and closure on. I think that's a good thing. And whether you're liberal or conservative, I think you actually do love this country if you're willing to ask those hard questions. And that's why I think it's a mistake, an unintentional mistake that many conservatives make when they try to tell people to shut up, sit down, and do as they're told. That's what the modern progressive left does. Let's not make the same mistake in return.
Yeah, and by the way, that was Vivek Ramaswamy talking about Tucker Carlson. My apologies on that intro. Vivek, exactly right, as always. Again, he's my top between Vivek Ramaswamy and the Colonel McGregor. Those are two picks that Donald Trump. The other pick mentioned a lot is Kristi Noem, and we're going to have discussion on that in the next hour. She revealed that she killed her dog, 14-month-old. And the other one is the governor of North Dakota, Douglas Burgum, and we're going to have some information on Douglas Burgum as well. And I don't think Trump should pick either of them, and we'll get to that as well. All right, we take a break. When we come back, Dr. Salvatore Giorgiani will be joining us, a men's health expert, senior science advisor to Men's Health Network, past chair emeritus of the American Public Health Association. And he is going to be, we're going to be talking about men's health. And we're also going to be talking about COVID, overuse of COVID and bird flu and public health issues. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned.
TNT's Jason Burmis.
Unfortunately, constantly, I'm talking to these political analysts that don't see any way out of the current situation except vote harder. And then every time that I bring up the fact that we have not only a corrupt system via the mail-in ballots, via the ballot harvesting, but the machines, I get a lot of radio silence. I get sometimes a nod and an agreement with me, but there's never a solution that's presented other than we need to go back to paper ballots and voter ID. Duh. Can anyone tell me how we get there? Can anybody tell me how we get there?
Jason Burmis on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Plug in.
Website?
TNTradio.live.
Check it out.
Today's News Talk Radio.
It's the coolest.
TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program now is Dr. Salvatore Giorgiani. I believe I got that name right. He's a 40-year career as a practicing clinical pharmacist, advocate for better men's health services, senior advisor to the Men's Health Network, past chair of the American Public Health Association. Welcome to the program, Dr. Giorgiani. And say your last name so we make sure I'm saying it close to right.
Well, you said it perfectly, and thanks for having me on today.
Okay, thank you. All right. All right, well, let's talk here. What should there's so much to talk about when you're talking about men's health. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a practicing pharmacist. You're an advisor to the Men's Health Network. What is the Men's Health Network? What's your goals, and why are you working with them? What needs to be done with men's health?
You know, it's a sad fact, a sad reality that at least in the United States, men die 6.8 years earlier than women do. They lead in 9 out of the 10 leading causes of mortality, death in the United States. And in general, they live sicker and shorter lives than women do. And a lot of that is due to preventable causes. We have a sex-driven gender gap, sex-driven longevity gap in the U.S. and in many other countries of the world as well. The U.S. is one of the few developed countries that does not have a formal policy or even an office that coordinates health policy for men. In the federal government, for example, in the U.S., there are at least 8 offices that coordinate policy funds for women's health. The Biden administration here recently announced a $100 million initiative to help enhance women's health, and that's all great, but there are no men's health offices in the U.S. In fact, 3 bits of legislation over the past 3 decades or so have failed to clear to get an even one office of men's health. So men are marginalized in terms of health in the U.S. It was bad before, and it's getting worse now. So Men's Health Network has been around for close to 30 years now. We work to enhance the understanding, access, and availability of health in ways that are meaningful to boys and men, where they live, work, play, and pray. We can be found at www.menshealthnetwork.org. So there's a lot of great information there.
All right, well, let's try to simplify this. Is there any biological gender-related reason why men should live shorter lives than women? Or you're saying, is it all because, you know, either sociological, men don't seek treatment, the system's not set up to treat them? Do men, for some reason, genetically, biologically, have a reason to live, what'd you say, 6.8 years shorter than women, less than women?
Well, let's go back to, as the saying used to be, let's look at the videotape. Let's go back to the historic data. In the 1920s, the longevity for men and women was virtually equal. You move into the 1950s because of war and other calamities, it started to decline for men. But now it's going up and down like a crazy rocket, but like just as if you were looking at a stock price, the trend is unfortunately down. So there are some biologic reasons that both men and women have, that there are differences in the way that their bodies develop, how long their cells remain healthy. It has a lot to do with hormonal factors, but there are also a lot of sociologic factors that look at men or influence the way men perceive health. If you look at a simple exercise for your audience, when you next time you're watching a bunch of television, just look at how men are portrayed in how ads focusing on health and wellness as opposed to women. Men are generally speaking, and this in many other Western countries, acculturated to think that health is not their responsibility. So one of the things Men's Health Network advocates for is men have to take a page out of the Women's Health Playbook and take personal responsibility for their own health. So as with most things, you know, it's not this or that. It's not genetics or environment. It's both, really. But the end result is this very, very unfortunate decrease in longevity. And on the other side, we even see the levels of suicide in men, which is by and large sociologically driven, is four times higher than that in women of all ages. And in this over 60 age, it's almost 10 times higher than women. And that's a sociologic fact, not a genetic one.
Well, you know, I would say if you go back, you went back, I guess, in the 1920s, a lot of the women's longevity could probably be attributed to surviving childbirth much better, as, you know, better modern medicine and other things helped them. And as you mentioned, wars stopped men. But my dad was World War II generation. He died over 10 years ago. But I remember he was mid-80s going to the doctor, and I remember him actually saying this, and this could be emblematic of his whole generation, but he said, well, you're going to tell the doctor about blah, blah, blah. He's like, I'm not telling him about that. It was a pain. He goes, he'll have to figure that out. He'll have to find that for himself. There was this idea that you weren't from, I don't know if it was generational or just my dad, but he wasn't going to tell the doctor. If the doctor was going to find something wrong with him, the doctor had to do the work. He wasn't going to make it easier. Is that part of men's psyche, or is that a unique attitude, or is that a... common among men and maybe the older generation?
As you were saying that, I saw an image of my brother, you know, floating across my face here. So yeah, no, it's a common thing, you know. But again, it's, I think a lot of it focuses in on men are acculturated to not think about health as their responsibility. So here, it's the doctor's job to tell me I'm sick. I'm not going to tell him I'm sick, you know. So I think, or her. So I think that there is a lot of unfortunate truth to what your dad said so many years ago that we still hear and see around. Guys, they don't want to talk about health. Men don't have a network that is supportive when they talk about health. When you come into work, if you start saying, gee, you know, my this hurts or my that hurts, as a guy and you're a leader of this broadcast community, as opposed to some of them, you're not going to reach a very sympathetic audience. We're taught from the early age, suck it up and take it like a man. And that continues on. So, yeah, acculturation that it's not my responsibility is unfortunately at the heart of a lot of the longevity gap.
And is that longevity gap, you know, every country in the world pretty much? Or are there some societies where men live longer? And is this something that you expect to close in the coming years? Do you expect it to widen between men and women, the age gap?
I can't say for certainty, sorry, every country, but the vast majority of countries where data is shared and we can have access to it, men tend to live shorter lives than do women in the current era. There are countries such as Ireland, Australia, United Kingdom, that are doing something about it and develop national level policies on men's health, but unfortunately not in the U.S. Do I think the gap will close? When I became chair of the American Public Health Association Men's Health Section many years ago, I looked to try and shrink that. That was one of the goals I set out. Unfortunately, that has not happened. And because of COVID, I am afraid to say that the life gap has increased dramatically. So I don't see that changing, unfortunately, because many of the isolation approaches and misinformation about health and health access, including trust and truth, which are probably the two greatest casualties other than loss of life from COVID, including the trust and truth casualty, are leading to a decreased longevity for men. And unfortunately, I don't see that coming to a screeching halt.
All right, now you were with the American Public Health Association, former alumni, Columbia University School of Public Health. You were a practicing clinical pharmacist. So here's my next thing, and this is getting a little controversial subject. I live in Virginia, and I would say, you mentioned COVID. Since COVID, there has been such a major pushback on modern public health, modern pharmaceuticals. Big pharma, use the word negatively. to the point now where I know many families now where vaccines for children out the window. I know many families now where cholesterol, men I've talked to, cholesterol drugs gone. They don't want to get on even heart medicine. They're looking for homeopathic. You have someone like RFK Jr. running, who I'm starting to largely agree with on a lot of this. But what, as a practicing clinician, a pharmacist, and having worked for these public health associations, what do you think of that? I guess I'll call it the holistic movement. I don't want to say anti-vax necessarily, but you know what I mean. So what is your thought on that? And is that a positive development? Because here's the next, before you answer, are we over-medicated? You were 40 years. Are we over-vaccinated, over-medicated? Because it seems to me we are. Like right now, if a doctor told me I had high cholesterol, I'm borderline, I don't know that I want to get on cholesterol medicine. I'd want to try other avenues or not even convince high cholesterol is bad. So much confusing information. So have at it there. I gave you a lot to chew on.
My gosh, do we have 3 days for our conversation? I'm happy to come back to talk more. But yes, I think in general, Americans are over-medicated. I never owned a retail pharmacy because I would make a very poor living because I'm constantly trying to get people to decrease the medicines that they take and use. And absolutely, a holistic approach to health is terribly important. You know, one of the things that happened during COVID is everybody was taught or told early on, which was incongruous to me and most other people who don't deal with people, get the vaccine and you'll be fine. You don't have to do anything else. That's not true. Exercise, vitamins, proper nutrition, sunlight, good mental attitude. Those were all important to getting through the COVID pandemic. But yet we were told that the solution is right here in this injection. So, and you just stay home, sit tight, and everything will be better. That's not true. It never has been true. And it's not going to be true for the next pandemic as well. This pandemic came at an absolutely unprecedented moment in time where everybody on the street corner became an instant expert in health. And I've done over 300 and some odd interviews, some on TNT on COVID vaccine. And what we've learned early on and then what we learned later on are almost the cognitively opposite. Now, in science and medicine in particular, we have those debates about what is the truth all the time. In fact, we're still debating the best way to take, if aspirin is a proper use for cardiovascular prevention. We're still debating the best way to treat diabetes. So that give and take in science goes on all the time. But during COVID, we had this whole dialogue, this whole debate, which goes on in scientific halls in the public. And then all of a sudden, everyone became an expert. And even people who were expert became marginalized because other more powerful voices came out. So I think that you have to balance both the use of medicines, and I would be silly to say and do it just a disservice to the audience to think that holistic healthcare and natural solutions are the only thing. And I don't think people like RFK Jr. say that, really. I think that's a misunderstanding. But you have to look at everything. Medicines have their role. Exercise has a role. Positive mental attitude and interaction with individuals has a role. And we need to get back to the way healthcare was practiced in the old days before COVID, when a patient had a conversation with a clinician that they trusted, who knew them, who knew their circumstances, who knew their community, and they made a joint decision about what is in their best interest, including the patient's preferences. We lost that. We had went through a period where governors and senators, holy mackerel, were telling us how to manage our health care. And that's just not proper.
Yeah, one of the biggest things, and you as a pharmacist, I remember my daughter was prescribed ivermectin, unless it was that or hydroxychloroquine, but the CVS, Walgreens, national pharmacies refused to fill it during COVID. They were actually told they would not fill it. That was not a medicine that they would provide for COVID. So we had to go to like an independent pharmacist 45 minutes away just to get that filled. That was the first time in my lifetime that I'd ever seen that. What happened there where pharmacists were told by corporate I guess, corporate government collusion that, no, we're not going to give this medicine out regardless of what doctors say. We are going to listen to only what the government says, and we're going to make our pharmacists obey. Did that ever happen to you as a working pharmacist? And did that surprise you when that happened during COVID?
I worked in clinics, and I worked in the DOD system and in lots of different places, hospitals, and state board. In this instance, it was kind of unprecedented. What was also unprecedented is state medical boards went ahead and did the same thing. What they did was they followed orthodoxy of the big kahunas over at NIH and CDC. And they said that we do not believe these should be used. We believe that the only thing is our scientific view. And here again, you know, we could have a robust discussion about how the notion that science is right this way because I said so, as opposed to science is an evolutionary sort of process, the truth. So it's very rare. It has happened not often, very rare for state boards of pharmacy to take a federal opinion and incorporate it into their practices. So getting it from an independent pharmacy was a very good thing. But I think that later on, what we also saw were not just that corporate heads that ran pharmacy and pharmacy practices made a determination you can't get it, but then also state boards did that to physicians. You can't prescribe it. Their employers would not allow them to prescribe it. And a lot of physicians, most physicians now are employees. And then, you know, it's just went up and down a chain. It's just a very bad way to establish practice.
Yeah. And we take a break. When we come back, I'd like to get into a little bit of how the whole world sort of went crazy in COVID, or I shouldn't say the whole world, but the public health in particular. We're talking with Dr. Salvatore Giorgiani. He's a senior science advisor to Men's Health Network and past chief emeritus professor of the American Public Health Association. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
While serving in Vietnam, a grenade took my ability to see. Today, I'm a sculptor, creating new visions. Now, my fingers are my eyes. As a veteran, I know the challenges of life can be great. In my art, turning a lump of clay into something beautiful, that means a lot to me. Life is like that. We each must use what we can to make things better.
DAV helps veterans like Michael get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
Now, I show others how they can create something with their own hands. With support from DAV, more veterans can shape their lives into a thing of beauty. My victory is bringing beauty into the world.
Michael Naranjo, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
The challenges our planet's animals are facing sometimes feel a bit heavy.
The animals haven't eaten in a day, 2 days, they haven't drank anything, they're cold, they're dehydrated.
But remember, there's good happening right now. At home.
All right, we were able to get into your unit and we have all four of your cats. So,
okay.
And around the world for any animal, any disaster. Search ifa.org/disaster-ready.
From economics to the woke agenda, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're talking with Dr. Salvatore Giorgiani, 40-year-plus career as a practicing clinical pharmacist, and he's also senior science advisor to the Men's Health Network. All right, doctor, you've been affiliated with Columbia University School of Public Health. And I'm sure that their COVID recommendations during the height of it matched Harvard, Yale, Georgetown, University of Pennsylvania, Southern California, every university, every major public health, every hospital, government. It seemed like everyone came on the same hymn page. Not a single ounce of dissent was allowed in 2020 and 2021, 2022. You had the Barrington Declaration of very notable individuals opposed to lockdowns, opposed to vaccine mandates, opposed to all the social distancing and quarantine of healthy people. They were vilified at the highest levels of government, corporate government collusion, intelligence agencies canceling. What in the world happened? How did everyone in public health get the message that they couldn't dissent? Everyone had to say the same thing. And even if it wasn't true, i.e. about vaccines, they're safe and effective, when they didn't even know if they were safe and effective, they just had to say those things. That had to destroy trust in public health. To just walk us through what happened. And again, in your 40 plus years as a practicing pharmacist, was this unprecedented in your lifetime?
It absolutely was unprecedented. And it is a cautionary tale that people have to take very seriously. When I say people, individuals in leadership, in health professions, as well as in academia, as well as in clinical practice. So really a lot of, there's a very tight network of individuals, which is facilitated, by the way, with social media, internet, activities such as this, you know, virtual discussions, where information is passed very, very rapidly from one individual to the other. There were, and still are, I think, a lot of noteworthy side conversations between individuals at state public health departments, the leadership within NIH and CDC. There were tons and tons of briefings being given. I was invited to several, attended several. They were all looking at orthodoxy. So sure, when within the first 6 months of when this happened, in early 2020, late 2019, depending on where you want to set it, sure, we had to give the scientists who were monitoring this a little period of grace for the first 6 months, 8 months, 10 months, year. But then they formulated an opinion, and then they stood by that opinion. And as someone who's been in academia at a couple of universities and worked with some very high-level research individuals in other parts of my work, there is a certain arrogance, if you will, and a certain stodginess that comes to making an opinion and sticking by that opinion no matter what. And I think that's what happened here. As data evolved, as experiences evolved, as we saw information coming from Scandinavian countries, from other countries where COVID was being handled a little bit differently, where new data was being presented, that what the problem was is that people's minds in the leadership, particularly at the federal level, were unchanged. That they didn't do the most important thing that happens in science, is that move along with new findings and craft new approaches. And that's a hallmark of good science. So when I heard a very noted individual probably making his case in front of Congress in the next little while say that I am science and challenging me challenges science, he got it exactly backwards. He is an individual, is expressing a knowledgeable opinion, but he is not science. Science is science. So I am hopeful that the tight rein the federal government placed on the leadership of medical associations, leaders in academia, to sing the same tune, because the stakes were so high that that bait won't be taken again. It won't even be tossed out there again. But I fear that's not going to be the case. I see shimmers of that with other things coming through. For example, this interesting notation about having avian flu in cow's milk, the panic, virtual panic that set in with mpox, formerly known as monkeypox. So I don't think we've learned an awful lot of lessons from the overreach of federal government bureaucrats and scientists and their general self-aggrandizement on scientific process. I think it's a terrible thing to happen.
Do your former colleagues agree with you, or is everyone kind of just, they're afraid to even speak out loud? Very few. I mean, how do they, you know, in other words, the trust that was lost. You know, so how do your former colleagues and people you associated with, are they all with you on that assessment that it was a mistake, or are a lot of them like, no, we did the best we could, and they're defending it to this day?
As with most complex things, they're dealing with complex, so it's both ways. Don't forget also huge amounts of research money that fund and fuel academic institutions across the United States, and even larger community health providing institutions, comes from the federal government, the NIH and CDC and HHS. Huge amounts of money. Also, huge amounts of money come from the pharmaceutical companies, not just the two or three involved in the vaccines, but all across the board. So there is a concern there that, gee, you know, we can't compromise our funding sources by going against what these folks are telling us is the right thing to do. So I think on one hand, there's a segment of the medical science society that says, look, we still have to give the power of the purse, the dominance over how we think and how we proceed. I hope that doesn't go the way it did in COVID, but I'm skeptical. On the practitioner side, I am angry as hell at what I saw happen, because I depend on the information that I receive from the government, from laboratories, from academic hierarchy, to package up and present and advise individuals both at a personal level and through communications like this. So I do feel too that that information was so heavily skewed that it led me to make recommendations that in hindsight I think were not appropriate and not correct, and I take it back. I can't do it every instance, but I think that I did learn a huge lesson about how information can be spun. One of the greatest ways, a great example, was when the former CDC director stated that there's a lower than 10% incidence of transmittal of COVID outdoors. And that was absolutely true, but the actual number was less than 1%. So sure, 1% is less than 10%, but she presented it in a way that I don't think stood the test of the whole truth and nothing but the truth. It was part of the truth. So that I think clinicians who rely on this complex interaction of government laboratories, academic laboratories, commercial laboratories, and state-level government funders and professional organizations, that whole web there, feel betrayed.
Do you think it was a mistake for President Trump to even attempt an Operation Warp Speed, which did a couple things, made it so that you couldn't be any viable drug as an alternative, because if there was, then you couldn't have the emergency use. And then, of course, by rushing this to the market, and then with all the politics involved, they wanted to mandate it immediately. Would you recommend the emergency use authorization? Was that a mistake to even attempt that vaccine and inflict that procedure on public health to where maybe that was the reason they couldn't, pharmacists wouldn't be allowed to prescribe ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine because, oh my gosh, if something else works, then they can't get the vaccine, which Fauci wanted, this video of him like 2017 talking about mRNA vaccines and lamenting the long approval process. Well, COVID gave them this, President Trump gave him the big hurdle. He removed the biggest hurdle to rush these to the market without proper testing.
Yeah, here again, it's very complicated. The emergency use authorization was, as some, unfortunately, sometimes happens, was overused. It still was in place long after it was necessary, particularly for things such as Paxlovid. So I think the EUA was an important tool. Don't forget, Mr. Trump, President Trump, was a proponent of trying everything. You know, he had that very large view, but he was reeled in by his experts. So just as I feel I was given skewed information to hold on to a favored position by high-level experts, I think he ended up thinking that way too. I know a fair amount about research and development tracks for products, and I still contend to this day, that shrinking the development and approval cycle for a product was a very good thing. Very important thing. It's not written in the Ten Commandments of drug development on stone that it has to take 10 years. It's not written that way.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We're out of time. But Dr. Salvador Giorgiani, the science advisor to the Men's Health Network, and that is available at menshealthnetwork.org. Thank you for joining the program today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a good rest of the day.
All right. And this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after these messages.